Hello, my name is Brian McKenna. I'm one of the editors of Computer Weekly, and I'm here to bid you a very warm welcome to the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
podcast.
And those two other voices were?
I'm Caroline Donnelly. I'm a senior editor at Computer Weekly.
I'm Claire MacDonald. I'm the business editor at Computer Weekly.
So last week we kicked off with some chat about Theresa May's lachrymose resignation. So who was she?
Who was she?
Yeah, she's gone now.
Well, she still is Prime Minister.
She still is our Prime Minister.
Is that, like, official? That is still her job title?
Yeah. She's still dining out on the benefits of it. Like I say, clocking up the air miles, flying to Brussels and doing whatever she can just to get a few more avios on her account before she has to hand it in.
She's probably having a good time. And this week, and possibly also next week too, we'll see how this goes. We're going to start by taking a look at some of the runners and riders to succeed Theresa May as leader of the Conservative Party and therefore our Prime Minister.
Can't we just get that cat to do it? You know, the cat that's always around down
Larry.
The street. Is it Larry?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Larry for Prime Minister.
So we're going to talk about some of these would-be Prime Ministers, specifically in terms of how they shape up in relation to technology. Try and stick to technology. We're going to park Matt Hancock, since we've given him quite a lot of publicity on this podcast.
Yeah.
We may come back to him maybe next week or the week after.
Yeah.
Caroline, you're going to talk about football?
Yeah, my favourite subject. I'm an expert on it through the lens of cloud, which is what we'll be talking about today. Google Cloud and its partnership with the Football Association of England and what it's doing there around data analytics.
And I'm going to say a couple of things about the National Archives project. Claire's going to talk about stuffing the mattress with cash.
Mm-hmm. Old school comes back. Old school way of banking.
And this is in Sweden, probably one of the most digitally advanced countries in Europe.
Yeah, seems a little bit of an odd piece of advice to be given, but we'll cover that in a bit.
We will. In the meantime, let's begin with these Tories. Caroline.
Yes. Rory Stewart. I don't think it's unfair to say that if you were to ask the average person like this time last week who Rory Stewart was, a few of them would probably struggle to place him. Like, I don't know, like, he's probably, I think I've seen him on Question Time, like, probably like the token Tory on there or something.
Definitely.
But this week, tell you who he is first of all. He is the MP for Penrith and the Border, but also the Secretary of State for International Development. Either way, you probably would struggle to place him until this week when he's hit the campaign trail pretty hard. And he's been using social media quite heavily for this. So he's been doing lots of kind of selfies and kind of announcing himself that, hey, I'm in Kew Gardens right now, come and talk to me about, you know, Brexit and the Conservative Party and whatever else, and like why I should be the leader of it and all this kind of thing. So he's been going around the country doing this. He's
dangerous, really.
I know. Pre-announcing yourself.
Yeah.
So yes, he's been in West London. He's been everywhere with lots of W's. So he's been, I guess, West London, Warrington, Wigan, and also Woking as well. But also Lewisham, apparently, for good measure. So he's been walking around trying to talk to people about what he's up to, what his policies are, and all that kind of thing. And as is usually the way when you're doing stuff like this so publicly on social media, he's come in for quite a lot of quite good-natured, I guess, stick for it. So I'd say the thing in Kew Gardens, he was like, hey, I want to talk to the public, come meet me in Kew Gardens. And people pointed out it actually cost £16 to get into Kew Gardens. And like, I don't want to talk to you that much. And then the other thing was, when he was in Kew Gardens, he was trying to, it's hard to explain when this is audio, but he was trying to do like the selfie pose, if you know what I mean, where you're holding your camera and it makes it look like I'm just filming here on my own.
Yeah.
And people looked at that online, like, hey, the way he's holding his phone, that can't be a selfie. There must be someone else standing there. So he's trying to sort of position himself, hey, I'm just like so social media savvy.
Yeah.
So someone tweeted him and said, asked him directly about it, said, are you pretending to hold your phone? And he just said yes. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of, I appreciated his upfrontness and openness.
He is quite an honest cove in general.
So
yeah, so honest that he's pretending to hold his phone like he's taking himself.
Yeah, but he said it's a fair call.
So he's been on the campaign trail, but he's also launched his campaign website this week. So he's got, so I was having a look at that just because, you know, someone look at these campaign websites, it's technology.
Yeah.
I was comparing it to his constituency website, which is these MP websites are odd anyway. It's just lots, a succession of lots of pictures of these people directly face on, just, hey, here I am meeting a person, here I am meeting another person. They're not very comfortable viewing, to be honest. And after seeing Rory Stewart's face everywhere because of all his selfies and his videos, it's a bit like, this is a bit much. And
yeah.
And I mentioned to Brian earlier, I was prepping for the podcast today on the train, had all these tabs open with Rory Stewart's face on it. And
whoever, like, stalking them.
Yeah, so that whoever I was sitting next to is probably thinking, oh my god, super fan over here. Yeah. I was like, no, yeah. I'm not, it's research. Yeah, so his new website it's a marker. I think someone who's gone from being an MP suddenly to I'm leader material. There's a big evolution in the design of his website, which it sounds like an odd thing to get caught up on, but the constituency one looks a bit like it's probably managed by someone in their spare time within his constituency, like in Cumbria, probably runs a jam shop or something, and it's like, hey, I'll look after your website. Whereas I want to be leader website, it's like boom, boom, like big fonts, like, you know, very, yeah, it's a big markup. So I don't know who is advising him on his technology strategy with that and his social media, but there's obviously someone quite savvy, either himself or someone else advising him. Outside of the realms of the campaign trail, though, he's also talked about some initiatives this week he's looking to introduce around climate change, which were quite interesting. So he's talked about that he wants to double... This isn't actually in the capacity of leader, this is in his existing job at the moment as Secretary of State for International Development. He wants to double the amount of foreign aid spent on tackling climate change. So
yeah.
Things like protecting endangered species,
yeah.
Protecting forests, but also research into renewable energy technologies and stuff like that, which is kind of pretty interesting for our readers, particularly, as I said, data centre people. They consume a lot of energy. They're always looking at, got one eye on regulation that might be coming on down the path that means they might have to change the way they operate and things like that. But I was also looking at some of his past things he's done around technology in government. He's been an MP since 2010. So he led the first backbench motion in 2011 for mobile phone companies to provide broadband and mobile coverage to 98% of the country.
Yeah.
So given his constituency, I'm guessing that's a focus on kind of rural communities, making sure they're not digitally excluded and stuff like that.
That's cool.
Yeah, so you kind of think, that is cool.
Yeah.
But then I looked at his voting record. A couple of red flags. If I've interpreted the data right, which I think I have, according to They Work For You's voting record data, he has consistently voted for the mass retention of communications data and for the mass surveillance of people's communications data as well.
Cool.
So that's all pertaining to, like, the Snoopers chart from a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So he's all for keeping, you know, having people tracked. But there was one other thing I was going to add, which was, apparently he was on Question Time last night, but I didn't see it because it was past my bedtime.
Yeah.
But like I said, I was tracking the Twitter noise around him on the way in this morning. And apparently he talked about how he thinks it's really important for policies to be introduced tackling the impact that AI will have on the labour market and the future of jobs. He's made the case for the introduction of a universal training income and mid-career retraining for people who might be losing their jobs as a result of AI coming in as well.
Ooh. Right.
So, yeah.
Relevant and important.
Yeah. Whether or not it will happen, I don't know. But like I say, there was quite a lot of positive reaction to that on Twitter this morning.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is important, you know, and it's something that a lot of people are in fear of at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, the AI as a buzzword, people don't think about the benefits, people are like, oh yeah, but everyone's losing their jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, as we talked about last week on the podcast, we're getting lots of research at the moment. The UK needs to be at the forefront of AI readiness, and a lot of that is the technology side. Can we make sure we've got enough people skilled to help us build AI solutions? But then at the same time, readiness should be, what do we do with the people that might be displaced in the jobs market because of it? So it's interesting. I personally haven't heard a lot of MPs or any kind of government talk on that issue of how you would address that. It is kind of, sometimes it's positioned a bit as, oh, it's a scare story, people are going to lose their jobs from AI. They'll just end up in higher value jobs or doing more rewarding work in other bits of the business they can't do at the minute or whatever. So it's quite interesting.
It's the sort of thing I would expect a Labour politician to say.
Yeah, are you either of you fans of Rory Stewart?
I like him as a writer. He does have this kind of fairly deep hinterland, you know, having done that big walk across Afghanistan and so on. Yeah, I mean, he has, does have an interesting background. I mean, it's very upper class, very establishment.
Yeah.
Eton, tutor to Harry and William and all that.
Yeah, did a lot of diplomacy in the, what's called foreign office.
Ridiculously early age, I think he was 28 when he was governor of a big part of Iraq.
Yeah.
How did he get that job?
Working hard and just knuckling down. Nothing to do with Eton, I reckon.
he's clearly a clever and cultured man. Who writes well and presents well. He's also said that he would not serve under Boris Johnson.
That's probably very wise.
So either he wins, or we'll never hear from him again.
Yeah,
if he goes into the night.
Yeah, because that has been the thing this week. Everyone's kind of assumed that Boris Johnson has got this all sewn up, and then it was, you know, this time last week it was just like, well, you know, there's, I think there's like the dirty dozen of Tory candidates now who are, have lined up to say, oh, we want to put ourselves forward. And everyone's like, hey, it's Boris's race to lose, basically. So, yeah, it's quite interesting that we are seeing other people trying, like, sort of rising up, or at least getting a bit more exposure, I guess, through social media or whatever, really.
Yeah, people know who Boris Johnson is.
Yeah, yeah, true.
And Michael Gove.
Mm-hmm.
But not any of the others, really.
Mm-mm.
No.
Even though Rory Stewart has had a couple of documentaries on that.
Yeah.
You know, fabulously popular channel BBC Four, and he does appear at Question Time and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
He's not well known.
No,
it'd be fair to say.
Mm.
But Boris Johnson is.
Yeah.
Clear.
So I had a little look into Boris Johnson's past.
Oh God, and that's murky.
Not that far back. So just having a little look at some of the things that we've covered on Computer Weekly about what Boris Johnson said about tech in the past, it sort of struck me that he started off when he was Mayor of London as a bit of a lovable buffoon and has since morphed into... I don't have words, but the difference between how people perceived him then and how people perceived him now, whether that was a little bit of a mistake to start off one way and then completely go in the opposite direction. I wouldn't call him lovable at all now.
Yeah, there's this attitude that he, or this kind of point of view that he's used the buffoonery as like a bit of a Trojan horse to kind of get into the public consciousness, and then it's like, oh, he's not a nice person at all.
But yeah, so when he was Mayor of London, it was very clear that he saw London as a possible tech capital of the world and directed most of his decisions as such, just to try and establish London as one of the tech hubs. Sort of started off around talent, so he wanted London to have 100 of the 1,000 skilled talent visas.
Mm-hmm.
So basically he wanted at the time about 10% of the allocated budget of skilled work visas.
Yeah.
Which seems a bit selfish, really.
Yeah.
Especially since, you know, London's not the be-all and end-all of tech talent in the UK.
Mm.
So that was in 2013. Obviously, the rules around skilled visas have changed since then, so there's different allowances and different types of jobs that are considered skilled visas. So he just sort of, you know, established himself with that. Yeah, so there's quite a lot of stuff from when he was mayor.
Right.
He wanted London to help Tokyo with financial technology. He wanted to make sure that there was a London 5G network by 2020. He wanted to partner with Israel.
Israel's got quite a big startup community. So there's an annual event that happens every year, I think, called Innovate Israel.
Yeah.
Which kind of, is supposed to kind of bridge the gap.
Yeah.
And they will give a London focus to what's going on over there and hope maybe some of those companies might get either acquired, but also we get exposure to their technology and stuff like that.
Yeah, so he wanted a lot of Israel's top technology talent to come over to London to strengthen the partnership with Israel from a tech perspective because of, as you say, you know, the scene over there is quite strong. But then also to help bolster UK tech talent. So you were talking about Rory Stewart and climate change. Boris Johnson more recently said that he wanted to use technology to try and fight illegal wildlife trade.
Mm-hmm.
So he was calling for finest technological brains to wherever they are, like, to come and help reduce the amount of illegal trade of wildlife, bad things.
It's interesting what you said about the 5G network, because obviously we will have a 5G network in London by 2020, so thanks, Boris. I was at that 5G launch last week with EE. And I was sat there and I had like the worst case of deja vu, because I remembered, oh my god, I was at the EE 4G launch and Boris Johnson was here. And I was like, oh god, he's not going to spring out from somewhere.
So when he was mayor of London, he was making all the right noises in terms of encouraging tech. And
yeah. I will just give a shout out to one of the other candidates as well, Esther McVeigh. I couldn't find much on her from a digital perspective, but back in 2015... when she was employment minister, she did launch a hashtag Not Just For Boys campaign to try and encourage more women into technology. Couldn't find anything else really since. Might just be my lack of research time, but you guys were warning me off her before podcast anyway, so maybe I'm glad that I didn't do too much digging.
So famously, Michael Gove stabbed Boris in the back.
Metaphorically.
I was like, I didn't know we were going to cover some murders.
The last time there was a leadership election, it's one of the reasons why Michael Gove is not trusted, of course, because he seemed like he was going to be Boris's biggest support, the two of them having been very prominent in the Leave campaign together. But then Michael Gove said that Boris was not really fit to be Prime Minister, which I think he's climbed down a little bit from now. So I'll just say a few words about my fellow Scot, Michael Gove, although Rory Stewart also is Scottish by provenance. Michael Gove always strikes me as a very strange man.
He really is.
Because he uses all this kind of revolutionary rhetoric to cover up what he does. He's always talking about Lenin and Malcolm X and the founder of the Italian Communist Party, Antonio Gramsci, says it's one of his great inspirations in terms of the work that he did at education. So he covers a lot of what he does in this kind of revolutionary rhetoric, and you do wonder if he's maybe wandered into the wrong party or something. But he is quite clearly a kind of Blairite, neoconservative, supported the war in Iraq, socially liberal as well, big fan of Game of Thrones.
Is he?
Which,
okay, that gives a new kind of take on the Tory leadership race.
Well, I think probably the thing he's most well known for as shooting himself in the foot in terms of maybe being electorally popular is his time at education, where he managed to enrage practically every single teacher in the country.
Yeah.
Half a million of them, ish. It's a lot of people to have pissed off. But he did do that thing. But while he was at education, he revamped the computer science curriculum in terms of GCSE A-level as well. Put a lot of emphasis on not so much using Excel and Microsoft Word as learning to code. So he and his advisors were very big on coding and introducing that into the new curriculum, which came into being in 2014. Some quotes that we've got from Computer Weekly. This is Michael Gove in 2013. One thing we can be certain of is that the acquisition of coding skills, the ability to think computationally, and the creativity inherent in designing new programs will help prepare all our young people better for the future. And in opening BET, the big kind of education conference in 2014, he said the previous ICT curriculum was out of date and so slow to keep up with industry changes that it was about as useful as teaching children to telex or travel in a Zeppelin.
I mean, a lot of people have argued that the new computing curriculum is also not fit for purpose. So you could pretty much just take that same quote, except change the last bit about Zeppelins, those are, and just change it to, using Microsoft Access.
Because you've said before, I think last week, maybe the week before, you touched on this thing that, you know, the emphasis on coding isn't necessarily the be all and end all when it comes to getting a tech career. Mm-hmm. But as that shows, obviously that government at that time was like, coding, that's it.
Let's go.
Learn.
And the types of coding that they teach as well. I mean, learning to code gives you a sort of overview of what coding means and involves. But the types of languages that they're teaching them in schools aren't going to be the types of languages that they'll need in...
No. A lot of them are gateway languages, so Scratch and the micro bit kind of building block languages. And that's supposed to... And for some kids, that's kind of enough. That's, mm-hmm. you know, that's when they sort of, you know, I'm kind of done with this. It depends mm-hmm. what they enjoy doing. But for some of them, it is a kind of gateway to going on to Python. So within our code club, we have a kind of transition... sort of program for kind of kids who have started out on Scratch and then they want to move on. You know, they're so enthused by what they're doing that I want to do more complicated stuff. I don't want to just do games and animations. I want to start either coding websites as well, like with a bit of HTML, or, you know, I want to make more complicated things. I want my characters to do more, like a wider range of things than I'm limited to in Scratch. So it really depends. I think in terms of stimulating an interest, they're quite useful. So kids will go on to maybe experiment with other ones, but it's, as they say all the time, about the leaky pipeline. There's so many ways out of a tech career for kids through that route as well.
Exactly. No one can expect a curriculum to be turned around within such a short period of time. You know, the tech industry changes so much every year that it's not actually possible to reflect that in the education system from a curriculum perspective. It is these extra things like code clubs that are going to end up, I think, giving the more time-appropriate skills.
So I'm sure if we dig around, we would find quotes from all of these characters and indeed some of the other Dirty Dozen about AI being the UK's future and how fantastic the UK is at AI and so on. So... Let's park these Tories for the time being and move on to data analytics in our national sport.
Yeah, football, a beautiful game. The Football Association of England have named Google as their cloud and data analytics partner of choice. And it's already kickstarted the partnership. By rolling out the Google Cloud G Suite of products, so their online productivity tools, to the managers of the various national teams that we have operating under the Football Association, and also to their players and also the support staff, to kind of boost collaboration and communication between them all. So that's kind of one part of this partnership, and that's, you know, that's fairly interesting. But probably the bit of greater interest is around kind of the potential I think the FA is seeing for data to improve how the game of football is played. So they've created this proprietary tool, this player profile system already, which is going to be running in the Google Cloud, and that is pulling in data around the performance of teams and their players, you know, their fitness levels, their training regimes, and just their general form. And then the hope is, by collating all this data and then using Google's various data processing and analytics tools and its machine learning technology, this system could create kind of real-time insights into how players are performing on the pitch, so that the managers can sort of make sort of in-the-moment decisions. Okay, that player needs to come off because they're behaving like this, and maybe they haven't had enough rest time, maybe, you know, they've got an injury that goes back a little while, maybe they're suffering with that on the pitch, maybe it's time to tweak the strategy as they're playing the games, which is quite interesting. Another part of this as well is the FA has this thing, which I've called the 2020 strategy, because it's, I don't know if they officially call it that, but when you look on their website, it's like, these are things you want to achieve by 2020. So I'm just thinking, bit of marketing for free there.
Well done.
2020 strategy. They are working towards increasing doubling the level of female participation in football. And also making the game more inclusive from a supporter's point of view as well, bringing in fans who traditionally might not have been that interested in football. So the FA looks after 28 different national teams. Obviously, you've got like the men, you know, the men's football team who were at the World Cup last year. But obviously, you've got women's football, but they've also have other teams, sort of senior players who've gone on from being like the national team, who maybe have aged out, and, you know, and also the junior teams as well. I think they have a team, an England team for people who have disabilities and things like that. So they're trying to, obviously it's an inclusive organisation already, but they're trying to improve and make it more inclusive, even more so.
Yeah, but...
Yes.
Personally, it has nothing to do with the game itself. Like, I would... If I were talking about football, I would just blanket say, I hate football.
Yeah.
Not true. I hate football culture.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to change that
mm-hmm.
using this.
No. Not necessarily, no. But one of the things is they're hoping with this data that they're getting, the teams themselves will perform better.
Yeah.
And as we saw with the World Cup last year, the better our teams do, the more publicity they get and the greater visibility there is of the players themselves. So you have people like Dele Alli, who my mum wouldn't know who Dele Alli is,
yeah.
but she can tell you, he's the guy who did the Fortnite dance and stuff like that. And it's kind of like, well, that's representation there, isn't it? That for a young kid who's like, oh my God, I know that dance, or I know that guy, or there's a player that looks like me on the pitch.
Yeah.
They're hoping it would get more people involved like that. And the same, so one of the things that within the 2020 strategy is that they're hoping this data will lead to the men's team and the women's team doing better or winning their respective World Cups mm-hmm. in 2022 and 2023.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hope. So if they do better, you get more visibility, that'll bring in more fans.
Right.
But I think the thing we saw with the World Cup last year as well is the current England team, the men's team, do seem to be a lot more savvy around social media and things like that. There was a lot more...
Yeah, they are.
They were tweeting a lot, so there's lots of kind of in-jokes that were doing the rounds on Twitter between them all. And then obviously we can all see that, so people were bought into the conversation.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not a huge football fan at all. I'm not even a football fan, but I got caught up in it. I was like, oh my God, I'm following Harry Maguire on Twitter now. I didn't know who that guy was. So I'm bought into it because they are sort of changing the game. They are, like you say, culture is born out of, I guess, what the image of the players put out as well, to a certain extent. So you've got... say Raheem Sterling, who has done a lot of work around kind of stamping racism out of football and things like that. He's got a platform through social media to put his messages out there, like, this is my treatment when I'm on the pitch, I won't stand for it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my treatment by the media, I won't stand for that anymore. So he's kind of making a stand, and that I think that would give confidence to people of colour who think, oh, I'd like to play football, but the culture is racist, inherently racist, and mm-hmm. things like that. So they get involved as well. Another part of it, like I say, this FIFA 2020 strategy is to get better fan engagement. And I don't know if this is like a strategy, the social media thing is something they sort of have trained them in, or if it's just the fact that this generation of players were brought up on with the internet being a thing their whole lives. So they're just a bit more like, this is what we do, this is how we, how we manage things, really.
The whole business of using data analytics to improve player performance, to do preventative medical stuff on them, to stop them from getting injuries.
Yeah.
It is being used a lot.
Yeah. And there is this kind of growing creep of technologies into football now. And I know there has been some opposition to it. So like goal line technology. So when you can't tell if it's a goal or not, and now they've got technology to go, yes, it definitely is. Mm. How many decisions over the years could have been like, oh, we should have won if there was goal line technology. You'll see the video assisted referee stuff as well, which I know there's a lot of opposition to.
Yeah.
People complain that slows down
the VAR. I love the VAR.
Yeah, you like it. Well, lots of people kind of like, oh, it slows down the pace of the game, or why can't we just rely on humans making mistakes?
And eliminate bias, though, don't you? Like referee bias. If a referee, no, referees aren't meant to be biased. That's the whole point.
Mm.
That they are.
Maybe
there will be.
But then, there is the argument as well. They can't have eyes everywhere, so it is supposed to fill in gaps where they're not able to make a call.
I think the VAR is a good example of augmented humanity. Myself,
I really.
It does add something to.
Yeah.
Well, like Claire was saying, I mean, they are humans. They have foibles. They can't see things.
Yeah.
Must be an incredibly difficult job.
When you think of the size of a football pitch and you're
one speed these guys are moving at, it's just incredible. It's absolutely incredible.
I don't necessarily mean they have a bias towards a particular team.
Sometimes they do, but I mean
they have a bias because they'll have seen XYZ before.
So you're like, that guy always tackles people and he's a nasty
B-word. You look like a kind of cognitive bias.
Or I've seen something come from that angle and then go over there, it's probably out.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. But there is in a way, because we've had like technology in loads of different sports for years, like Formula One, for example, but football in
tennis
a way.
Tennis as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Football seems a bit slow to get with it. I think there is a kind of opposition from some fans that, you know, the game's always been played this way.
It's
traditional. Yeah. And in some instances, it can work in their favour. Like, you know, you can't tell if a goal's gone or not. And other times it works against them. So I think it probably depends on what, you know, side of the fence they are with that regard, whether they are pro or against it. But but it's interesting to see them embracing technology in that way.
I like it.
Data analytics, yeah. And now I'm going to talk briefly about a little story we had this week involving blockchain and AI. So we're going for buzzword bingo. So this is a story that's kind of around our National Archives, although there are other National Archives involved in this project, but it's basically a project at the University of Surrey called Archangel. And it's quite complicated, but these guys are presenting a paper this month at an event in Los Angeles. I want to get this right. So the researchers are from the Centre for Vision, Speech and Signal Processing. There seems to be, well, indeed there is, a kind of unit at the University of Surrey which has got something like £3 million from UKRI, so UK Research and Innovation, and it's very blockchainy. So they have a number of blockchain projects, and this is one of these projects, and it's all about ensuring the integrity of video within archives to show that, you know, to make sure that no one's tampering with the archives. So that's where the blockchain comes in. And the AI bit is to do with generating a signature from the video that can then be in the blockchain database. I think that's basically the way it works. Although it does sound very, very kind of techy and super advanced and kind of cool, actually, to be honest. It's I think it's a pretty good project. The Open Data Institute is also involved as well. And yeah, it just seemed like quite a good use of the technology, quite an innovative use of the technology to try and safeguard our archives. So the title of the paper that this is based on is Tamper-Proof Video Archives Using Temporal Content Hashes on the Blockchain. So
simple.
Yeah, it rolls off the tongue.
But it's safeguarding the integrity, well, potentially safeguarding the integrity of video that's stored in our National Archives, or indeed other archives. It's not, we're involved, our one is involved in this, but also Estonia, Norway, Australia, and the US has got some trials going on with this. University of Surrey developed technology. Jenny Tennyson from the ODI said in a kind of the statement for this story, it's becoming easier to manipulate digital records, which makes it crucial for the institutions that take care of those records to be able to demonstrate their trustworthiness. So I think the drift of some of this is to say it's not fair to just rely on like the National Archives to ensure the integrity.
Yeah.
There has to be, you know, with digital stuff, there has to be other ways and technology, kind of independent, objective technologies that will do that for us. So, yeah, quite a cool application, I thought.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of examples where that could happen. Like, could you edit out, like, say, someone who's an assassination of, like, a president? Like, oh, they weren't even there! Like,
it's all fake news and all that.
Yeah,
this is to kind of militate against fake news, so what's not to like there?
Yeah.
That's enough of digital. Let's go off the grid, Claire.
So, yeah, interesting story this week from one of our Nordic freelancers about Swedish people being advised by the Swedish Civil Contingencies Agency to have at least 1 week's worth of cash stored within their house in case of a digital emergency. So, I am all for apocalypse planning.
Yeah.
You know this. I have an apocalypse plan.
Of course.
Have you?
Yeah, of course I do.
Do you keep it under the bed?
It's not under the bed.
She doesn't write it down, because then people will know. You've got to be one step ahead of the looters and all that kind of thing
in
that situation.
Sorry, no one's listening.
Well, we've said enough then.
Yeah. Speaking of looters, so basically if you think of how much cash you would need to survive for 1 week.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you know that everyone in Sweden has that amount of cash in their house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doesn't it just call out for crime?
You could have a huge payday just going, like, doing yeah. one road
should
a
we,
week.
Yeah. Should we catch a plane?
Yeah.
Should we go up? Should we make a plan?
Yeah.
But basically, it's part of provisions when you're advised for different types of emergency. There's, you know, like a banking crisis, or they
yeah.
can't pay for something digitally, or
yeah.
they can't access
yeah.
their cash.
Like we had last year, like where the visa outage.
Yeah,
and
so
like
people couldn't get their cash.
Yeah,
yeah.
it's only for like an afternoon or whatever, but it did highlight straight away, like, oh my God, like we use cards for everything now
yeah.
as we move towards this cashless society.
Yeah.
Do you really need a week's worth? Like, what kind of thing must occur
kind of
that you just think I might be without money for a week?
So they were saying the list of risks. So it was natural disasters, forest fires, storms, terrorist attacks, military conflict,
yeah.
things like that. But then, would cash really mean anything?
Yeah.
Sweden is almost completely cashless.
Yeah. So do you think they can see something on the horizon that, oh God, you know, we're just at the cusp of, like, at the moment we've never had a week-long banking
yeah.
outage or cyber attack against our cashless society, that, you know, this could happen.
So I think that it's based on some past experience. So in 2008 there was a malfunction in Swedish central bank system. So it was unable to contact the outside world using regular IT solutions, as the story said. So I think that happened. And then in 2007, internet banks in Estonia went down. I think that they're just being precautious, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's quite close to Sweden, isn't it?
Yeah.
Estonia is very digital
yeah.
Society as well.
They do everything, like elections, all sorts of things.
All sorts
yeah,
of stuff,
that'd
yeah.
That'd be cool if you could do that.
Yeah, which makes them quite vulnerable as opposed to the Soviet Union, the ex-Soviet Union.
So yeah, I get being cautious. I also... It's a bit strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
When was the last time that anybody kept a roll of cash in their mattress?
Yeah. Yeah, but like so it's like a generational thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is a generational thing, yeah. One of our other colleagues who is from Norway, she tells the story about one of her relatives having just masses of cash in
yeah.
the house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think now if you saw that, like a relative or whoever with loads of cash in the house, you would assume, or I would assume, it's probably like money laundering, gangster, like your a life of crime maybe of
yeah.
some, you know,
yeah.
some persuasion.
Line mm-hmm. of duty territory
yeah.
again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Fun story. A bit
yeah.
odd.
Yeah.
But how much is like a cash for a week?
I
it varies from person to person,
yeah.
obviously. But what, like 200 quid?
And then some weeks you spend more than others.
Yeah,
so, you know, outgoings
pizza
being
weeks.
What they are. Yeah.
What I thought was quite sweet about this story is the Swedish Social Democratic State clearly still feels that it has a duty to look after its citizens.
Yeah, it's
nice.
I thought it was quite sweet.
Nice to be advised.
Yeah.
There wasn't an official number, it just said enough cash to buy groceries and other necessities for a week.
And other necessities, yeah.
I suppose you might have to park pizza week in that instance.
It's a necessity.
Right, so what are we doing over the next week then, guys? Are we out and about at events
mm-hmm.
and so on?
Yeah, I'm out and about next week. I'm in Monaco, as I mentioned last week, for the Data Cloud Europe
what?
Event. I'm also off to Hayes in West London.
And
they've got
the glamour.
Week. Yeah, to go and visit Rackspace's offices there. Rackspace City, as it's known locally. And then, yeah, back in next Friday for the podcast.
I actually have a relatively quiet week on the event front for once, which is nice. I'll just be catching up mostly.
I too am event free.
Yay.
Next week.
Oh, wow.
Got a few face-to-face interviews, one with Cindy Housen, who's one of the big brains of business intelligence, who's gone to a vendor
mm-hmm.
called
mm-hmm.
ThoughtSpot. So I'm going to catch up with her early next week. I think that's probably all we have time for this week. Just
mm-hmm.
reminds me to thank Caroline.
You're welcome.
Claire.
Thanks.
And thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.